Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Welcome to the Dear Lovejoy podcast, sponsored by Cooker, spelled Quooker, pronounced Cooker. And today is another Dear Lovejoy special.
Woo!
Yes, today we're having a conversation with Steve Backshaw. I love Steve. He's one of my favourite people to interview just because I'm so envious of his life. He travels around the world going on expeditions, going on adventures and just seeing things that I would love to see. I thoroughly enjoyed this conversation. We covered so much from his time doing martial arts to all his little adventures around. Well, I say little. That's the
it's not exactly just going to the shop, is it?
Understatement of the year.
For a baguette.
Absolutely huge. And we talk about, you know, putting his life at risk and everything else. What was the other things we were discussing? We discussed
Actually, we should point out this is actually part one of a part two Dear Lovejoy special, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, because when I asked Steve to do the podcast, he said, would you fancy doing my wife as well, Helen Glover? I said, oh, yes, please. Can she come down? Olympic medalist. So we did them both today, and both of the podcasts are, I just thought, really fascinating insight into what's great is insight into both their lives and insight into each other's lives
and
via
also
the other person.
A couple of shared things. They built a house together, and you get both sides of that. Both sides of they've just had a baby.
Yeah, so both sides of what it's like to go out with an Olympian, and also what it's like to go out with someone who goes on adventures for a year,
6 weeks at a time. Yeah, you know, yeah. So it was a great double bill. So we'll do this one this week.
So this is Steve Backshaw this week, and we will do Helen Glover next
MBE
Monday.
Next week.
Yeah. Okay. So for the time being, let's meet Steve.
This is just a guide to modern life. Modern life is hard to get just right. It can frustrate you and annoy. And if it does, right into Dear Lovejoy.
Steve, thank you very much for joining me today in my kitchen. I buy all my guests presents. I had no idea what to get you, so I bought you something really random. Sour cherry and dark chocolate biscuits. I'm not sure you eat biscuits. Do you eat biscuits?
Unfortunately, any biscuits that are placed in front of me are pretty much gone the second the wrapping comes off. So I'll probably have finished these by the end of the podcast.
But the world's gone mad now. I mean, who wants to eat sour cherry and dark chocolate? But I thought, you know, let's try something different.
But Scottish shortbread, two of the greatest words in human history.
Beautiful. I was just saying I'm excited about interviewing you today. Whenever your name comes up, I've got to tell you this, whenever your name comes up and we're presenting Sunday Brunch, Simon and I look at it and go, oh, thank God for that. Because you know you're going to have a good conversation with you. A, because you're a good person to talk to. But also your life is so brilliant that we've got so many questions to ask you. Do you think you have the best life?
I do. I think I'm incredibly fortunate to have got to a place that so many people want, which is doing what you love for a living. But also to a stage where it is still fun. I think a lot of people take on things that are their passion for their career, but after a while, because it's their job, it starts to lose the shine. I think because my life has so many different elements to it, it always keeps you guessing. And that can be in the fact that one day I can be focusing on one particular animal and the next a totally different one that I may never have seen before. It could be that I'm bouncing from the Arctic to the desert, to mountains, to the oceans. Or it could be that I'm, you know, one day presenting an expedition show in the middle of nowhere, and the next day I'm doing the one show or something like that. It's always different. And because it always keeps you guessing, there's no chance of getting bored.
Yeah, your life's not boring. That's true. But as well as doing all that, and we'll talk about your expeditions in a minute, because I'm fascinated by that. But I keep reading that you've built your own house, your own eco house. When you've built your own eco house, does that mean you've ordered one online which has been delivered? Or does that mean you actually put it together? How does it work?
That's what I hoped it would be like. It's been an experience, and not one that I would recommend to anyone. We kind of had all of the things that you see on Grand Designs and think, if I was going to do a house, I wouldn't do that. We've done every single one of them. It's been, in some ways, the worst nightmare. In others, the greatest sense of achievement, I guess. You know, we were very, very lucky in that we found a remarkable plot on the river, close to where I've lived for the last 25 years. And it had a dilapidated, rundown place that was on it. It was barely livable. But we bought it in the hope that we'd be able to build something there. It took us 2 years to get planning permission. We moved into a houseboat and built this house, which is it's a kind of log chalet, a Scandinavian wood chalet. The idea was that it would be totally off-grid and that it would be, you know, supplying power back to the grid and all that sort of stuff. And all of that's happened at least three times the price of what it should have cost. Oh. And we've had horror show times with builders and project managers and all that, which has just taken the both of us to the edge of our sanity.
Do you actually do anything, or are you just getting people in to build? Have you actually got your hands dirty doing this?
Our intent was that we would do nothing at all. That was what we hoped.
By the way, you keep saying we, it's you and Helen Glover.
Yes, that's so right. Yeah.
Your wife, yeah.
I very much didn't want to do anything. I am the least technical person you can possibly imagine. Plus, you know, the both of us are super, super busy. The last thing we wanted to be doing was, you know, going and digging trenches for drainage ditches that didn't exist, or, you know, putting in water butts or fixing ceilings that are leaking on a brand spanking new house. But all of that has had to happen because we just got horribly let down by people. So it's been a crushing experience. But then at the end of that, to look around your own place and see, you know, your dream house become a reality, that's pretty awesome.
Though it must be sort of team building as well between you and Helen.
It kind of has been. I think, you know, for both of us, because we've had so many other things going on during that year where the house was built, there has been the ability, I guess, to be able to just, you know, take a deep breath and go, okay, it might seem really important right now that the roof's falling in, but actually in the grand scheme of things, that's just, you know, it's not that drastic. You will get around it. And I think the fact that our lives have been so crammed full of so many things this year has enabled us to just take things easy when it could have driven us beyond stress. I can understand that people who throw themselves into it in its entirety and do nothing else can be driven insane by it.
Mm. Must be quite good having Helen, though, as a partner, as a wife, because she's I imagine she's quite proactive on these things as well, isn't she, being an Olympic athlete?
Helen's incredibly driven and incredibly focused. But I think that she's not very organized. She's the first person that will admit to that. And so I think that an awful lot of building a house is about getting your logistics right.
Yeah.
And so between the two of us, that's been really, really hard. And that's something that I hope that somebody else would just do for us. And that didn't happen. And so
By the way, Helen's come down with you and we're doing a podcast with her as well. So I'll ask her about
it. I'd be interested to hear what her take is on it.
What is an eco home, though? Do you mean you've got solar and everything else? Or is it just that all the bits have come, have been sustainable or something? I don't know. I'm trying to think of the words.
Bit of all of those things. All of the wood is sourced from Scandinavian pine, all of which is planted to double the amount that you are harvesting.
Perfect.
The water is from a remarkable system, which is a water source heat pump that goes in the river. I don't understand it, and I've tried to explain it so many times to different people, but effectively the latent heat from the river gives us our heating for the house. We have solar for our energy, a composting system using a wormery so that we are not in it. We have a borehole for water, so we're not in any way connected to the mains, and essentially it's just going to be totally self-sustaining.
That's brilliant. How does that make you feel then?
Amazing. Yeah, amazing. smug, really smug.
Well, yeah, because one of the things I keep thinking of, I keep reading about, you know, say Prince Harry at the moment and all that, all those guys who've done their big conference wherever they went to talk about climate change and everything. I think all the public are champing at the bit. I think we all want it badly.
Mm.
And I think we, no one wants single-use plastic, but it's hard to shop without it. I think it sort of feels like it's up to the politicians and up to the supermarkets and everything to do it. We're all ready for it. I think we're more than ready. So you saying about your house there, if a solar panel thing became accessible to my house tomorrow, I'd go, yeah, let's do it.
Yeah. That part of things has been an eye-opener. I figured that I would have to make massive sacrifices and that it would be a real big deal to make this house, you know, eco-friendly, for want of a better word. Yeah. It isn't at all. And there's no reason why the government couldn't implement plans tomorrow that every new build that's put in place shouldn't be to a degree self-sustaining. You wouldn't have to use water source heat pumps. You can use ground source heat pumps. Every house can have some degree of PV or solar, regardless of whether it's going to provide all of their energy needs. And then having super effective insulation. That's one of the biggest things with our house. All of those things, if those were in place by law, we'd be cutting a massive amount of demand from the national grid. It would be huge, you know.
You'd lose votes though, wouldn't you? As soon as you said, I mean, it's different with cars. You can say, look, we're gonna these cars have to come off the road or they're taxed more, because a car is, you know, but a house is somewhere you live. If they start telling me that I have to insulate my house in a different way and it's going to cost me money,
New builds, if all new builds had to be done with those things in place, you're talking about 150,000 homes a year potentially. That is a lot of energy which could be drawing from the national grid or could be being provided by the house itself. It seems like a no-brainer to me.
Yeah, I'm out of my depth because I don't know anything about building
me
properties.
Either, but I'm pretending.
But it sounds right, and it sounds like something we should do. Look, you're also, you know, I say you have the greatest job in the world. You're also a proper human. You built your own house. And you also, black belt at judo, you studied martial arts in Japan. How on earth did you end up doing that? What an amazing experience.
Yeah, so I've done martial arts since I was a kid. I started when I was about 4 or 5 years old. And judo was something that I always loved all the way through my childhood. And then I had a year before I went to university where I went traveling and I met a lot of people who had gone to Japan and they'd spent time learning Japanese and teaching English. And it seemed like a pretty good thing to do. And when I finished university, a lot of my friends ended up just being channeled straight into dead-end jobs. And I didn't want to do that. So I thought, I'm going to go out to Japan. I'm going to spend a year studying martial arts and just give myself a little bit of time, a little bit of a buffer to try and figure out what the next stage in life is. I had the most incredible year in Japan. I learned to speak Japanese. I learned a lot about the culture. I lived with Japanese people, spent my entire time in the dojo, essentially. And it was an incredible year.
For people who don't know, dojo is where you train.
It is, yeah. Yeah. And it's very different. A dojo in Japan is very, very different to a dojo here in the UK. So, well, I mean, most dojos here in the UK are basically a bunch of mats thrown down in your local leisure centre.
Right.
Whereas in Japan, I was studying in this ancient building with giant stone pillars running all the way down the outsides. And at summer training, we had 1,000 black belts on the mat at one time.
Wow.
The sight and the sound of it was jaw-dropping. It was like something out of a James Bond movie, you know, one of the Roger Moore movies where he kind of opens a door and all of a sudden he's surrounded by all these people making loud judo sounds. That's exactly what it was like. It was great.
How good were you?
I was probably average. I think, you know, here in the UK, judo is not our strongest sport. We have some very, very strong players. But whenever they go out on a world stage against places like Brazil and Korea and Japan, where it's something that everybody does from a young age, we usually get smashed.
Right.
And I think that if I pushed it really hard, then maybe I could have competed internationally. I competed in some national competitions in Japan, but I would never have got far enough to have made that commitment worthwhile.
I think one of my biggest regrets is not doing a martial art, because I was so obsessed with football that I just used to play non-stop constantly. And I think the discipline martial arts give you, I think it's a great lesson to take through life.
It is. And I'm a little bit looking at the way that martial arts is going nowadays, and it seems like some of that's being lost. So a lot of modern mixed martial arts seems very much geared towards sort of untempered violence in a way that my study of martial arts never was. I mean, for me, martial arts was always about restraint and about a set of rules and a set of guidelines. The amount of respect that you have to have the second that you walk into a dojo is incredible. There's almost an extra level of language that you use in Japan when you're inside a dojo, which is adding an extra layer of politeness to every sentence you speak. And the degree of you know, respect that you have to have for your opponent and for your sensei, your teacher, is huge. And I see modern mixed martial arts, and it, you know, there's a lot of the kind of the wind-up that you get in boxing, and there's a sort of a degree of unrestrained ferocity that I think is probably not the best example, which I always saw being given through martial arts. I always saw it as being a way of giving people a code. And I really hope we don't lose that.
Yeah. Jiu-jitsu's the big one, isn't it? That's really taken off in the world because you can't win MMA, mixed martial arts, unless you can do jiu-jitsu.
Yeah.
So I suppose that must be overtaking judo now as the sport that everyone wants to do. But they're very similar, aren't they?
They are, and they both originate in Japan, although Brazilian jiu-jitsu has taken it to a whole other level.
Yeah.
But I guess, you know, jiu-jitsu itself is an ancient martial art that has exactly the same structures as judo would have.
Yeah.
In fact, judo was kind of like the competitive form that originated out of jiu-jitsu. But yeah, I look at modern MMA, and although some of it I find really, really exciting to watch, I think, would I want my young son to be getting into that? Probably not.
I see. The thing is, I watch it. I love all the hype. Same with boxing. I love all the build-up. But when people are actually getting smacked about, I find it quite hard to watch. Mm. I don't know why, but the actual skill level is unbelievable. And the idea that you're putting yourself in a ring or a cage, whichever you're putting yourself into, and the bloke standing across can actually damage you is so bizarrely brave, but it's a ferocious thing to do, isn't it? Are you competitive?
I am competitive. I think that I've learned a lot about competition since meeting Helen. If you'd asked me this question 6 years ago before I knew her, I would have said, I am the most competitive person you will ever have met. And then I met Helen and I went, no, I'm not like even in the top 20,000. She is a total different level. And I think that what I've seen from Helen is that an elite athlete is a very special kind of character. And they have a focus that I will never have and could never have, and a singularity of purpose. I mean, one of the first things I talked to you about was the fact that I love the diversity that my life has. I love the fact that there's, you know, a million different aspects to it. And I love that I have the opportunity to get average at whitewater kayaking and average at climbing and average at canyoning or caving. Would I want to do one of those things to the exception of everything else? No. And certainly not would I want to do it 3 times a day, 7 days a week for 8 years. It would drive me insane. It would drive me absolutely nuts. And actually, when it comes down to it, I think my competitiveness has kind of always been with myself as opposed to with other people. You know, I'm always seeking to do the best that I can at certain things. But I'm pretty relaxed about being beaten, whereas Helen is just like, you know, I can see that if I play her a game of badminton, she has to win or there's going to be trouble.
Does she win?
Everything, absolutely everything.
Because I have that, I've tried to tone it down. I have that thing where I can't stand losing. I'm that sort of competitive, but I've tried to tone it down now and I'm trying really hard. I have to take big, deep breaths. Even when I lose to stupid board games with my kids, I'm like, calm down. Now you brought it up with Helen, I'm going to speak to her later. I might as well ask you, what is it like going out with an Olympian? Only because I said, when the 2016 lot came back, when I started interviewing them all, obviously Helen was one of those on the show, and I kept on saying to them, what's it like for your partners? Because they have to be so focused and they have to be extremely, I'll use this word, but I don't really mean
this
word.
You can use it. You can use it.
It's kind of selfish.
Yeah,
because if you don't, you're not going to win a gold medal. And then when you're not exercising, I imagine you have to rest. So what is it like to actually be on the other side of supporting someone who's going to win a medal?
It was one of the worst experiences of my life, I have to say. Because, it is extraordinarily selfish. And Helen would be very upfront about telling you that. but particularly coming up to the Olympics itself, for several months beforehand, we were just completely shut off from each other and there was almost no contact. And within the Olympics itself, which is this event that means everything to the person who is the most important thing in your life, you have no say, you have no impact, you have no control whatsoever over what's happening. But I couldn't even talk to her. I couldn't even have a conversation with her. And all of that was next to impossible. And watching every single one of her races, from World Cups to European Championships to World Championships to the Olympics itself, was a horrible experience. I you know, sitting there in the stands and watching these things happening.
Because you wanted to win so badly.
Yeah, and you can do nothing about it. Yeah. Absolutely nothing about it. So yeah, I hated it. But in the aftermath, being able to see what it means to have all of that effort come together in one crystallized perfect moment is something incredible. I think that it's very different for a sport like rowing, which is so Olympics focused, to, for example, a footballer who has a massive moment every single week of their lives. You know, every week they go out and play in the Premiership, it's something massive. And maybe you have something bigger in a cup final once a year or once every few years. In rowing, you have 4 years where everything is about that Olympic final. Everything is about those 7 minutes of perfection.
Yeah.
And so coming towards the end of that Olympiad, the kind of the degree of stress and pressure and sometimes outright fury that builds up is extraordinary. And it was, as a partner, really, really difficult to deal with.
And then afterwards, once you've won, because Johnny Wilkinson said after winning the World Cup, it was horrific afterwards because you've spent all that time building up. And then what next?
Yeah, so I think we were quite lucky in, first of all, we spotted it way before the Olympics. We said, we know that you're going to take a break after this Olympics and it's going to be really hard. And so we prepared for it.
Okay.
And we did everything we could to make sure that we had loads and loads of things lined up that would mean that she would never kind of get that sense of, what am I? Who am I? How am I defined? The first of which was we got married 3 weeks after the Olympics.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah. That'll take your mind off it.
It does. Well, yeah. And I think that, you know, for most people, getting married can be quite a stressful experience. For Helen, it was sort of like, well, this isn't even the most stressful thing I've done this month. Or, unfortunately, the most exciting thing that she'd done that month. But, you know, that's one thing I just have to live with. But then after that, we planned a whole bunch of things, some to do with work and with getting into the media, other things with races and with fundraising and charity events and things. So that I think she never got that crushing low that a lot of athletes have. And, you know, we met so many people, worst of all, people who have worked towards the Olympics and then not achieved their goals and then come out at the end like, I've just wasted this huge portion of my life. I am no longer a rower, a runner, a cyclist. I'm just, who am I, you know? And I think, you know, luckily Helen didn't have that.
I spend the whole of my time telling my children, especially my youngest one, but my twins are 17, I've spent time telling them, you're supposed to lose. I keep telling them they're supposed to. And I did this thing with Jamie the other day, who's my youngest, who's six. I said, Jamie, she's doing maths at the moment as well. I said, if 10 people in a race and one wins, how many lose? And she went 9. I said, yeah, so the majority of people lose a race, okay? Even if they come second or third, they've lost. Come on, get your head around that now, because that is the way to go. And I think it's getting worse with the hype, because sports brands and everything only ever talk about the winner. And actually, they've got rid of the team now as well, because they're not interested in the team, they're interested in the individual. The one winner, it's always about one person. You know, it's always Ronaldo or Messi or whoever you've got at the moment. And I think children are buying into this idea that unless they've won, they're a loser. And no, competing is just as important, he says, getting angry when he loses to his daughters. My kids, by the way, absolutely love you. Because they grew up watching you. And obviously, they've seen you on my show a lot as well. But they've read the books and everything. That must be wonderful for you, that you've introduced so many children to nature.
Yeah, it's been, without question, the highlight of my career. And it's been something of an accident. I found myself on the Really Wild Show after 5 very happy years making wildlife and conservation programs with the National Geographic. And I didn't particularly see that as being, you know, a big part of my life. I was on it for 3 years. But then when I started doing Deadly 60, something really, really special happened in that we got to the end of this program, which, you know, we filmed for exactly the same reasons as we film everything else, because we think it's going to be fun and we think it will make a nice television program. And then we started getting buckets of emails and letters, and not just saying, hey, we love your show, but particularly the ones that really made an impact were getting letters from people saying, I have an autistic son who has had no connection with anyone or anything, and all of a sudden has seen your show and has decided that animals are his thing. Mm. And we wouldn't get one letter like that. We'd get thousands. And it just, you know, it just broke me apart. You know, I'm getting emotional even talking about it now. But seeing the impact that simple show had on so many people, and eventually it, you know, went around the world to 500 million people, 157 countries. And, you know, I could rock up in bizarre countries around the world where I didn't even know that we were showing, and people go, oh, the Deadly 60 guy.
Oh, brilliant.
And, you know, I'm getting to the stage now where a lot of the kids who started watching it in 2008, 2009 are just finishing their marine biology degrees and finishing their zoology degrees and getting in touch and saying, you know, I started on this road because I saw your show and thought it looked cool. And that's just amazing.
The reason why it works, and again, the reason why I always love you having on TV shows I do, is because you're enthusiastic. Your enthusiasm for it comes across. And that is what makes good TV. If people are enjoying themselves and they have a passion for what they're talking about. How did you get involved in it all in the first place? Where did it all begin?
So in television or in Deadly 60?
Television. How did you get into it in the first place?
So television was it wasn't something that I've been looking to as my future for a long time. I kind of figured that I was going to be a writer. I figured that writing was the thing that I was good at. And I managed to get myself a job as a travel writer working for the Rough Guides, writing guidebooks to Southeast Asia and Indonesia. And fantastic a job as it was, it turned out to not pay much. / anything. I ended up moving back in with my parents in my mid-20s and working in bar jobs to you know, pay the rent. And it became very obvious to me that making a living as a writer was going to be really, really hard. But then I got one freak job with a paycheck that was big enough that I could buy myself a video camera. And I went out to Colombia for 6 weeks and I just self-filmed myself in the jungle, catching snakes and spiders and scorpions, living rough, made it into a short film. And I sent it to National Geographic, who bought the film and to all intents and purposes bought me and took me on as their adventurer in residence. Still the greatest job title I've ever had.
Brilliant.
Which was how I spent the next 5 years. And it was amazing. I had a boss who kind of just threw me in at the deep end and was prepared to let me make my own mistakes, just gave me a camera and a credit card and said, you know, go and do the things you do, film it, edit it, make it into programs. I'd make them. He'd say, they're rubbish, go back and make them again. And I learned all of my mistakes on the job and had 5 blissful, blissful years learning how to tell a story, a wildlife story, an adventure story through television.
What happened to you though that rather than see a snake, a scorpion, a spider and think, I need to avoid that, you're seeing a snake, a scorpion, a spider, I need to go and touch that and pick it up and look at it and investigate it?
I've always had that. And I've actually met lots and lots of kids who are the same, to an extent where you have to be shouting at them constantly, don't touch that! But, you know, all of my earliest memories and all of my parents' earliest memories of me were kind of like me going through the compost heap trying to find grass snakes you know, picking up worms and eating them and looking for beetles and birds' eggs. And I was very lucky in that I grew up on a small farm, on a small holding in Surrey. And so that was just completely natural to me. We were surrounded by woodland. We had the Surrey Heaths within walking distance. And so all of that getting my fingers dirty and going out and grabbing animals was just how I grew up.
Yeah. Have you been bitten by anything?
I've been bitten by quite a lot of stuff. It's been the trick is making sure that you don't get bitten by anything nasty. I mean, I get nips and scratches and things all the time.
Have you been injected with? I can never remember the difference between venom and...
Yeah, it's venom. If it bites you and you die, then it's venom. If you bite it and you die, then it's poison.
Right. Okay.
So if it's injected into your bloodstream, then it's venom.
But you don't have to die.
You don't have to die.
No,
that's true. They
can bite you and it hurts. Which
one? A bee sting is venom, and you don't
right,
die from
okay.
that. So what have I had? I've had several scorpion stings. I've been stung by an adder here in this country, which is one of the most ironic things that's ever happened to me. I ended up in hospital after my adder bite. And I don't know if you remember it, but there used to be a program hosted by Matthew Kelly, which was a London hospital program. And they came round and they were interviewing all the people on the ward. And they came and interviewed me because I had this adder bite. And they kind of got to the end of it and went, hang on, do you that guy off the telly? yeah, that's me. And I just literally
stood. What does it feel like?
It was really sore, actually. I was out walking the dog bare feet as I always am, and I must have trodden on it, got bitten on the ankle, and it kind of went black all the way up the back of my leg where the lymph glands had been filled with venom. I was fine a couple of days later.
Did it hurt?
Yeah, it did.
What's the pain feel like?
It made my leg feel really heavy, really really heavy, like I could almost not pick it up. Heavy,
right?
But. The sight of the bite itself was kind of like a wasp thing or something.
And what about a scorpion? What does that feel like to be?
So there's lots of different kinds of scorpions, and some of them are seriously, seriously venomous and, you know, could potentially kill you. And most of them are wasp sting kind of feeling. And
right.
I've had quite a few of those. I've had one really nasty one, and I had 24 hours of absolute excruciating pain in the middle of nowhere as well, so with nothing to treat it and with that slight sense of please don't let this develop to anything worse, because this
again,
will be bad
again. What does it feel like? Because I had someone on my show once who has brought a load of creatures and talked about venom, and that's what he does. He tours around, really lovely bloke actually. And I said to him, have you ever been bitten? He said yeah. And he goes, I don't really talk about it on the show because I shouldn't be bitten, because he goes, one time I didn't do total safety stuff and I got bitten. And he got bitten by like a dragon-y type thing, not a Komodo dragon, but something which looked a bit like that.
Yeah.
It might have been a Komodo dragon, something like that. And I said to him, because he said, that one there, don't, you know, never get bitten by that thing there. And I said, what does it feel like? He said, for just under a week, it felt like I was running my hand under a hot tap.
Whoa, that's full on.
He said that it was just unbelievable, the pain, just excruciating, just wouldn't go. And it was just hot tap, hot tap, hot tap. And every time you moved it, it was hot tap. Is that what it felt a bit like for the scorpion or not?
No, so the scorpion was, what was it like? It was a real thudding pain.
Thudding pain.
It was a real thudding pain. The worst I've had was bullet ants. So I did it about, I guess about 12 years ago, I did a program that was just on venoms. And the end of it was to do a ritual with a tribe called the Sotere Mawe in Brazil. And they have an initiation rite that their young men do in order to make the transition through to menhood. And what they do is they take these ants, the biggest ant in the world, it's about the size of your little finger. And each one has a sting that's said to be as painful as being shot. That's why they're called bullet ants.
Yeah.
And they'll take hundreds of these ants, weave them into a pair of gloves with the stingers on the inside. And then the young men put the gloves on onto their hands.
God.
And they dance for about 15 minutes, getting stung over and over and over again, hundreds of times. And for 3 hours after doing it, there was nothing in my world apart from pain. I couldn't have told you if there was someone standing next to me. I couldn't have told you my name. I couldn't have made any connection with anything apart from pain. It was searing, total, completely throughout my body, not even vaguely localized to my hands. For 24 hours afterwards, it felt like someone had an industrial road digger pounding up and down on my hands.
Why did you do it?
Because I think, first of all, I felt that if I was going to do a program on venoms, I needed to at least sample some of it myself. And a lot of venoms have a very high chance of a histamine reaction. So a bee sting is a really good example. You know, you can have an allergic anaphylactic reaction to one single bee sting and something serious can happen. Whereas this venom from the bullet ant is very, very pure. It has very, very few histamines in it. So your chances of a histamine reaction are very low. And so you can take a lot of these stings and it hurts like you would not believe, but your chances of a single allergic reaction to it are low. You know, there's other kinds of venom, like this rattlesnake venom might have cytotoxin, or spider venoms have cytotoxins, which can have a necrotic effect. So one single bite could start to rot your flesh. Well, you don't want that, do you? But with a bullet ant venom, I knew I could experience it without any long-term damage. But the amazing thing was that 24 hours after the ritual, when the pain started to subside, but your body is still zinging with all of these hormones, basically all the stress hormones that your body's gone through, but also this incredible amount of adrenaline, I felt like I could fly. I felt like a superhuman.
Amazing.
And it lasted for at least 3 or 4 days after the ritual. And I wonder if that's one of the parts of the reason why the tribe does it. First of all, because, you know, you're facing your fears, you're showing that you're brave enough and you're strong enough and robust enough to experience the pain. But at the same time, you get this revelation at the end of it of just utter euphoria.
Yeah, that might be. It's funny when you get that pain that hurts so much that the only thing you can concentrate on is the pain and nothing else. Mark and I were out once in a bar and this guy offered us this chili. What do you remember the name of the chili, Mark?
Was it a ghost chili?
Chili jam.
Or a Reaper. Carolina Reaper.
It was one of the hottest chilies in the world. And he said, do you want to try some? I tried the tiniest bit and the pain was so much that I was standing there, people were talking to me and I was going, don't talk to me. I literally standing there like nothing. I only lasted for about 5 minutes, but for 5 minutes it was excruciating pain from just eating a blooming. Are you good with chilies?
I like my chilies.
Do you?
Okay. I wouldn't go that far.
I do, but this was just so hot, it was painful. Let's talk about your expeditions then. You went off, the last project you did was amazing, 10 expeditions. You wrote the book to go along with the expedition, and you basically decided to set off for a year to go and explore places that humans hadn't been to before.
Yes.
Mad idea. Could you get insurance for that?
It was tricky. We were probably quite judicious with the truth when we talked to the insurers about what we were actually going to be doing. It's a project I've been trying to get off the ground for a long time, and it's really, really difficult. The boring side of it is, I guess, that media companies, television companies are quite risk averse. And they want to know what they're getting. Yeah. And so over and over again, I take it to television companies. I go, I've got this amazing idea. I've got all these places that people have never been to before. How exciting is that? That in the 21st century, there are cave systems no one's seen. I can take you into them for the first time. I can take you to the top of these mountains. And they go, okay, so what are we going to see? And I go, I don't know. That's the beauty of it. And they go, oh, yeah. But seriously, though, what's going to happen in act three of the film? And I go, that's the beauty of it. No one knows. And they kind of nod and you could see them just sort of like losing their interest. And so it's been really, really difficult just getting the money together and the funding. And then we were super, super lucky that we met the guy who's the commissioner at Dave Channel, last person that I would have thought to approach with this. And he was just totally on side with it and totally bought it. And once he got behind the idea, all of a sudden we managed to get all these other companies involved, including the BBC and 140 other countries around the world, got the money together to go away and do 10 expeditions in a year.
See, that's what I thought when because if you think about the Big Blue Planet or any of Attenborough's things, made by the BBC, but sold around the world, people like nature shows, don't they? They always work. So surely it's a great investment to invest in you.
Well, no, it's a that is the big difference in that those big, what we call blue chip natural history programs are as guaranteed as it is possible for a program to be. You know, they will send their cameraman and researcher into the field for anything up to a year at a time to bring back a sequence. And they have 20, 30 crews off simultaneously around the world filming. They are going to bring back an amazing program. Mm. It is going to happen. You know, they're making a whole bunch more at the moment. You can guarantee that when they come back, they're going to be brilliant. They have usually 3 or 4 years that they're being put together, being made by the best possible people. And so they will always come up with new behavior. They'll always come up with glorious, astounding shots, and they will always do really well around the world. The risk with our series is that, you know, what happens if we don't make the top of the mountain? What happens if we get there and we have a bunch of renegades come in and steal all our stuff and we don't even get to make a program? What happens if I get sick? What happens if I get injured? All of a sudden, all the money that's been put into the production just disappears. Mm. And those kind of risks are the things that people are understandably not willing to get behind, because, you know, it's an expensive business doing things like this.
Before we go into in detail, the in fairness to Helen, she was had to be selfish before going off to do her Olympics. You're suddenly going and leaving her with a baby for a year. That's a big decision for you, and she's got to be very understanding about that.
Yeah, it was massive. So we had Logan, our first child, 2 weeks after I came back from the first expedition. So I was away for 6 weeks when she was 9 months pregnant. And then just a matter of weeks after he was born, I was away for another 6 weeks, and then back for a bit and another 6 weeks and back. You know, it was full on. And we sat down and had a very serious conversation when we got the first interest for the series to be made. And we sat down and kind of thought, right, okay, so I've been pitching this series on and off since 1998, seriously since 2006. It feels like the sum of my life's work. It's a massive, massive project. But if it's not right for us at the moment, then maybe we just have to let it slide. And Helen made the very good point that, you know, we both have a lot of friends who are in the military. Her rowing partner, Heather Stanning, is in the army. And she said, people in the military do this all the time. You know, they have, one of them has to go away for long periods of time, and it can happen at times that are just not right for the family, but you do it and you work through it. And we have, and although it's been incredibly hard, and I think, you know, the hardest bits for me have been the fact that, you know, you've got a young child who is changing daily.
Yeah, tough for Helen because she's doing all the heavy work with Logan. But also tough for you because I imagine you want to be a hands-on dad and you want to be around watching your son grow up.
Desperately.
Yeah.
And when they're young and they are a fledgling human, sometimes, you know, from 1 hour to the next, it seems like they're evolving into something different.
Yeah, 100%. They go away for a couple of days, come back bigger. It's
amazing. Yeah. And one of the things with expeditions is that, with a couple of exceptions, we were in places that were hell and gone from anywhere. We had no contact with the outside world. Very, very rarely you'd manage to get a satellite phone call in, but you certainly weren't FaceTiming home. And so I, for the first time in my whole career, was homesick, really brutally homesick, which has been really tough. And I'm not allowed to complain about it because Helen had it far worse.
Okay. So why haven't these places been discovered? Or they probably have been discovered, but why haven't humans really been to them? Why aren't we living in these places?
There's all of them, for different reasons, have been undiscovered. So with, for example, the cave diving, cave diving is something that once you get into it, all of a sudden you realize that there is a whole new planet on Earth that we just know nothing about. There's such a small percentage of the world's caves that have actually been explored. And in the area that we were going to, the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico, it's a really well-known area. You know, there's Tulum and Cancun and all these places with Playa del Carmen with millions of tourists. But if you head a few miles into the forest, you find these holes and tunnels and sometimes big gaping open sinkholes that drop into flooded cave systems that extend for hundreds of miles. And a tiny percentage of them have been explored. And once you start diving into them, you find places where categorically you're the first human being ever to go. And inevitably, they are staggeringly, jaw-droppingly beautiful. The reason that people haven't gone to them is, first of all, there are an awful lot of them. And so the ones that are relatively accessible get dived by lots and lots of people. And then the ones that are less accessible get dived by a handful. And then you go just a few miles or a few hours into the forest, and nobody's willing to carry their tanks on their shoulders and hack through dry forest to try and find if a little hole goes somewhere. There's only one or two real genuine explorers who are doing it. And so joining them, we managed to go to places that, you know for a fact no human has been to. And in this day and age, that feels pretty special. In other places, it's just remoteness. You know, the jungle in Suriname is so vast and there are so few people in that country, all of whom are clustered at the coast, that once you go into the interior, you're in this badlands of jungle where nobody ever goes. Likewise, you know, Greenland, the world's largest island, which Donald Trump would very much like to buy at the moment. God love him. There are mountain ranges there where you can drop a pin in the map and every single mountain that you look at has not been climbed. So it's been a case of picking our targets, doing our research. A lot of people ask, how do you know? How do you know no one's climbed that mountain? Well, people record it. You know, if you put a lot of effort into doing an expedition to climb a mountain in the middle of the Arctic, you certainly tell people about it. And so there are records for all these things. And as long as you do your homework and you make sure that you tick off every box that you possibly can, then it's a first ascent, a first descent, a first exploration.
It's really dangerous. what you do. Does it worry you?
It's been worrying me much more since I've become a dad.
Yeah.
I probably had that, you know, the invincibility that, yeah. that young immortal, men have that yeah. tends to drop off around about your late teens to early 20s. Kind of never did for me. Mm. And I, you know, still was well into my 40s feeling like I am invincible.
Yeah.
And then I became a dad and all of a sudden it's kind of, not so much. And, you know, there are plenty of things that I don't want to be missing. And you do start to get that sense of perspective and sense of a bigger picture with fatherhood. And so all of a sudden, my attitude to risk has definitely changed. To have it happening halfway through a year-long expedition project was probably not ideal, particularly because we had some of the closest near-death experiences I've had on this project. But I've certainly had much more cause for thought after them than I ever have before. Normally, I you know, something happens, it's a little bit near the knuckle, and afterwards I'll be like, oh, that was close call, and then I pop out and have a beer. Now I'm much more likely to sit down and really think about yeah. how I do things differently.
What's harder, going into cold climates or hot climates?
They both are challenging for different reasons. Very, very cold, like Arctic cold, is quite easy to prepare for because you just have shed loads of down, all the right equipment, and apart from going to the toilet, which is always an absolute shocker, it's relatively easy to prepare yourself.
Yeah, how do you go to the toilet? Oh, I've always thought that when they're carefully. Out in this ridiculous cold, you know, you can't get your bits and bobs out, they'll freeze off.
Yeah, exactly. And you're trying to get them out through like 6 inches of clothing, which obviously is no problem, but I mean, yeah.
Needless to say.
Oh, no, it's a horror show. It's an absolute horror show. You know, particularly when we were doing the Arctic sea kayaking as well, we're wearing dry suits from head to toe. So getting to the moment where you want to go to the loo, you can be putting it off for 2 hours going, it's okay, I can make it. I can make it to the end of the day. I can make it. No, I can't make it. I definitely can't make it. It's always the worst part of everybody's day.
But what do? You just have to get it out and risk all your stuff getting cold. Isn't
yeah,
that?
Yeah, you do. Okay. I mean, everyone who does expeditions is going to have a poo story of some kind. And it's not pretty. It is not pretty.
Well, the other thing, which isn't, it's funny because I remember I talked to you about this on when you came on Sunday Brunch, is you see you in the jungle and you go, oh my God, that just looks amazing. The stuff you're seeing is absolutely incredible and stuff that no one else has seen and is so green and beautiful. And then it sort of occurred to me, which I brought up with you and you confirmed, is that, hold on, there's going to be lots of things then that are going to bite you and eat you and stuff like that. And you, it's so alive there, isn't it? You actually had fungus growing on you.
Yeah. The thing about the rainforest is it's not going to kill you in a massive rock falling on your head or in you toppling over a precipice. It breaks you down like Chinese water torture. It's that constant drip, drip, drip of just crotch rot and chafing and mites and leeches and ticks and chiggers, these little burrowing mites that get under the surface of their skin and lay their eggs and they itch like fury, sometimes for weeks on end. There are caterpillars that I've been stung by, caterpillars that have these urticating hairs all over their bodies that you brush them with your arm and still 6 weeks later you get a bit sweaty or you have a shower and you brush it and you feel this burning nettle rash come back at you. I have come back from these trips with black fungus in my ear, which I've had to have syringed out, mold literally growing on my armpits and in my crotch, all of my clothes basically falling apart like a walking manure heap. And it just starts to get to you after a while. But at the same time, it is relatively easy to, if you can manage to get your logistics right, it is easy to survive there for long periods of time and kind of do fine. It just chips away at your morale in a way that is excruciating.
Well, what's going to kill you first, though? Is it going to be the weather? Is it going to be a malaria, some disease, or will it be a wild creature, a bigger creature?
Malaria is something that we usually worry about, and other sort of associated mosquito-borne diseases are usually worst when you're coming close to human beings, because it increases in its propensity to be spread when you have plenty of hosts.
Mm.
So once you get deep jungle, miles and miles away from anywhere else, your chances of getting malaria are pretty slim. And that's, you know, not something we worry about hugely. Likewise, things like giardia and gastroenteritis and all the stuff that you get in a jungle where you're quite close to human beings are not such a problem when you're miles and miles away from anywhere. There's much less chance of having pathogens if there's no human beings to spread them and for them to multiply. Snake bite is much less of a concern in the jungle than people expect that it will be. We have, in all of our expeditions, had, I think, only one person with a venomous snake bite. And we're talking about thousands and thousands of man hours in the field. And actually, touch wood, we've never had a serious injury in the rainforest.
Well, what's interesting is when you're walking around, though, somewhere like the rainforest, all the animals come and look at you, don't they? They're like, who's this thing walking around? And, you know, you've got footage of that, the monkeys arriving and stuff like that. But are you never worried that something might think, well, that could be dinner?
There are certainly situations where that is an issue. When we were in the Arctic, that was very much an issue with a polar bear. There are very few animals around the world that will deliberately hunt, kill, and eat a human being. Big crocodiles are one. Polar bears are one of the only mammals that it is a real serious issue with. And we had one particular issue with a polar bear who just marched across this Arctic beach towards us over the course of several miles. And for the first, you know, mile and a half or so, we're all standing around going, this is the most amazing thing. It's just us and a polar bear up here in the Arctic. Oh, and he's coming so close. Look at that. He's coming really close. And as he got closer, it became quite evident. I could see through my binoculars that it was a male. He was probably a third year male. So he'd just been dispersed from his mother. He was a little bit scrawny. He had a scar running down his snout, which meant he probably had a fight with another male. And he all of a sudden started exhibiting all of the signs that take an encounter from a curious one to a predatory one. So he dropped his head. He was shaking it from side to side. He was kind of walking from side to side and assessing us. We scared him away, and then he turned and came back again. And that's one of the, you know, the big ticks in the box of, right, okay, now you have to do whatever you can to get rid of this bear.
How did you scare him away? Gunshot.
We used gunshots. We used bear flares. We had bear spray, which is usually your number one deterrent. It's kind of like mace, it's pepper spray.
That sounds something like Batman would have when he had shark repellent.
Yeah. But it's because they have a sense of smell that's thousands of times more potent than
brilliant.
That of any guard dog. If you kind of hit them with pepper spray, it really sends them running off faster than a gunshot would. But it was very windy, and if we'd unleashed the pepper spray, I'd probably have just taken down my entire team, but not the bear. So, yeah, we just did everything we can. We came together as a group, made a lot of noise, banging everything we could. We fired a couple of shots over his head, and eventually, luckily, he turned and went. And for me, the big problem was not that I was frightened any of us were going to get eaten, because we had the guns. You know, he wasn't actually going to manage to get to one of us and kill us. But if he had charged those last few meters, then he would have had to have been shot.
Yeah.
And that basically would make my whole career and my whole life a total mockery. It would be the worst thing that had ever happened to me, you know, to kill this vulnerable animal up there in the Arctic, when essentially you've gone there to talk about how his world is falling apart. Would just, it would have been the end of everything.
When I interviewed Megan Hine, I love Megan Hine. She's written a great book. When I talked to her on this podcast, she said one of the things she's most worried about are humans, and some of her biggest interactions have been with drug gangs or something running out in the forests, or when she was going to go on a solo trip, she was worried about being a woman. She just was taking her dog on these solo trips and stuff like that, and she would be worried about humans. Has that ever come into your psyche, that there could be humans out there who are saying, hold on, there's some guys with some cameras and some money and stuff?
Yeah, people are far more frightening than animals could ever be. And it's mostly because human beings are so unpredictable. All of my most frightening encounters in the wild have been with people. I've been held up at gunpoint several times. I've been shot at several times. We had one particular experience on a river in New Guinea where we were trying to make the first descent of this river from source to sea. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, we had this military attaché turn up in the middle of the jungle and say, we've just had word that the local gorillas are coming down. These are human gorillas, not mountain gorillas. Yeah. The local gorillas are coming down out of the mountains with their AK-47s to kidnap you. They are talking about this as being their big money payday. And essentially, you're just never going to be seen again. And so we had to up sticks, transplant ourselves from where we were, get a helicopter over the mountains, missing out this whole section of the river that we were supposed to be paddling down through, or we would just have been taken. And then when we got probably another 100 miles further down the river, about 3 weeks later, we were at the riverside, as far from civilization as it is possible to be, just ourselves in our team of about 8 people, all paddlers. And these guys just came out of the forest with their machetes in their hands and their bows and arrows drawn. And for about 15 minutes, the looks on their faces was just absolute fury. And the machetes were raised and the arrow points were kind of, you know, aimed at our midriffs. Luckily, I speak the local language and I kind of spent 15 minutes just kind of trying so hard to placate them and doing all the things you're supposed to do with lots of eye contact and lots of kind of, you know, gentle sort of, you know, physical contact, things like that. And it turned out that essentially the only contact they'd ever had with anyone from the outside world had been people coming in looking to take their resources, looking to take their trees, looking to take their copper, their gold.
Where was this?
This was in New Guinea.
And what language is it?
The language that I speak is Bahasa, which is a kind of lingua franca that covers the entire region. So New Guinea itself has about 1,500 different languages. And so there's this one language which was used by pretty much everyone in the western half of New Guinea, which I speak from my first job working for the Rough Guides. And eventually we managed to placate them. And an hour later, we were all sat round kind of, you know, drinking tea and having fun together. Aldo stitched up a wound that one of the guys had in the back of his hand that he, you know, hit himself with a machete, and we patched it up with stitches and things. And then they all left and we found ourselves sat around the campfire as it was getting dark and all went, do any of you think that you're going to sleep tonight? No. And we all went, no. And we hopped back in our boats and in the middle of the night paddled down a class 4 whitewater river that we had no idea what we were paddling into, just to get ourselves as far away from the situation as we possibly could.
You know, when I said you had the best life ever?
You just changed your mind.
Just changed my mind. Yeah. That's so nerve-wracking. But I imagine when you get off the other side of it, it's an amazing experience. What is it that you know, because you see so much of the world and we're all stuck in our cities or our towns and villages around Britain and stuff. What is it that you know that we don't know?
I think it's so difficult to say this because it is going to sound like the most stratospheric cliche in history. And I'm going to sound like some kind of patronizing Western liberal saying it, but we came to, this is one example, came to a village at the end of our trip in Suriname, 35, 40 people living in the middle of the forest, all the families living together as a unit, the old people as important, more important for their length and breadth of experience and knowledge than anyone else, living a life of simplicity where they have what they need but not everything that they want, with plentiful time for their friendships and for their family, and just not beset by all of the pressure and the greed and the things that kind of, you know, hold every single working day down for the likes of you and me. And we all looked around and went, these people have just got it right. And there's so much that we could learn here. And we all left going, what can we do to simplify our lives? What can we do to take our foot off the gas and to reconnect with our families and make sure that, you know, our parents and our grandparents feel valued and have a role in life? And what can we do to make sure that they have a part in bringing up our children, that we all work together as a little community? And 4 or 5 days later, you're back in the UK and you forget all that and it disappears out the window and you're back to the grindstone. But that simplicity in life is what we're missing.
Definitely, 100%. I couldn't agree with you more. And that's what you keep coming back to that, and I keep slipping, and I keep trying to get back to the simple things in life, because it is true.
I'm the worst at it. I'm not particularly materialistic, but I'm a horrific workaholic, and I will come back from 6 weeks on the road doing an expedition, and someone will say, "I've got this job, do you want to do it?" And I'll go, "Yes." And then I'll get a few hours with Helen and Logan and go, "What am I doing? This is what's important. Why am I saying yes to all this work that I don't need?" And I guess...
Though in fairness, I interviewed an astronaut once and I said to him, "What's it like?" He goes, "It gets so weird because you're up. And that you, when you go into space, you look, you always think you're going to look out. You're going to look out at the other planets and stuff and the solar system." He says, "You don't. You spend all your time looking back at Earth. You can't help it. You're drawn to it because that's where we all live. And everything seems so puerile and churlish and just, it seems ridiculous that there's all the wars and the fighting because you just see this beautiful planet." And he goes, "And you come back and you feel, you know, the world should be as one." And then you get in your car a few weeks later and someone cuts you up and you're like, "Ah, bastard!" And you revert back to how you are, this sort of human, and you realize you're only human. And so you know, we're all the same, aren't we, sadly. And just finally, because I don't want to take up too much of your time, we've got Helen as well here today, and what do you think about climate change? What are you noticing? You've been out doing these expeditions for how long now? I mean, would you say you've been out
20 years?
What have you seen in the last 20 years?
So I'm in a position now where all of a sudden my experience of climate change is becoming experiential. I made my first program on climate change in 1999, and I have revisited many of the same places repeatedly over that time. I've revisited the science as it's evolving. I've gone back to places where I have seen a glacier retreat in real time. I've gone to places in the Arctic where the people can tell you, where in living memory, all of a sudden they have fish in their seas that they don't have names for. They have insects turning up in the summer that nobody has ever seen before, and their peoples have been there for 2,000, 3,000 years, where they can look around and say every single one of those valleys there had a glacier in it in 1985 and they don't anymore, where the sea ice is melting earlier and forming later. Other way around, where it's forming. Yeah, no, that's right. Where the sea ice is forming later and melting earlier than it has done in, well, over a million years since the beginning of the last ice age. I see climate change in real terms, in ways that you can see and touch and feel, not just in statistics and newspaper articles and peer-reviewed scientific literature. And there is no question that it's happening, absolutely no question. The absolute scientific consensus is that it's happening, and that it is caused by anthropogenic human forces. And that's something you can see as well. You know, I've been going to towns in Asia that were small silent towns in the 90s, like Hanoi in Vietnam, for example, you know, a place where that you wouldn't see a vehicle, all you'd see would be bicycles. And then you go back in the late 90s and already everyone's on mopeds. You go back in the 2000s and it's turned to cars and trucks, and you go back now and it is a metropolis of millions of people. So you see the world changing in ways that has to have effect larger than just localized ones. You know, the total destruction of the forests in Borneo and Sumatra, I have seen happening in my lifetime, and I've seen the results of it. I've seen the haze that has covered the entirety of Southeast Asia in 1997 from the burning of the forest. There is no way that that can just dissipate and have no impact in the long term. Of course it does. So climate change is a reality for me. How we deal with it is very different. You know, it's very difficult. I have the great problem that, you know, a huge amount of my life has been traveling, and aviation has been a huge part of my life. And that's something that I have struggled with a tremendous amount. It is definitely time for us to step up and make big changes.
Elon Musk is saying that one of the biggest problems is air conditioning. The population of my lifetime has doubled, which I always liked. I'm 51. I'd always like to put that fact in because it's kind of important. We want to live in hot countries, or people do live in hot countries, but they want them to be cool. We want to go into shopping malls and them to be cool. So, you know, Middle East, Vegas, even now Britain, we're all starting to put air conditioning into our houses, even though we only get a month of hot weather a year. It's kind of, he's saying that it's kind of a crazy situation that we're doing that, but that's one of the problem. He's trying to work out good batteries for it. That's how,
yeah.
That's
and how, that's conversely, the exact same is true in cold countries. Mm. You know, there are more and more people that are heading up into cooler climes. There are 4 million people living within the Arctic Circle itself, and tens of millions in the subarctic. Yeah. we all have huge impacts from the way that we live our lives. For me, you know, struggling with, do I give up my job completely in order to not be flying anymore? Do I give up the voice that I have, which is facilitated by travel? At present, I'm sticking with no, but what I'm doing is I'm offsetting. So I'm putting a lot of time, effort, money, fundraising into buying massive chunks of rainforest, which act as a carbon sink to offset what I'm doing. Whether in 10 years' time, 15 years' time, I can still justify traveling at all is another question. But, you know, it's very difficult.
I would level at you that you're very valuable because you have done so much traveling, even though you're right, you've got a bad carbon footprint because of that. Your knowledge and experience, as long as you're doing it the way you're doing it, you're not just flying around to try and make money. You're not going around to do business deals. You're going around to look at the environment. So your knowledge is invaluable to us now. So we need you to keep doing it, but we need you to keep spreading the word.
I hope that is correct. I think, you know, there is a question there. Inevitably, you know, is it true that we should not allow our climate scientists to travel to get the knowledge they need to tell us about climate science? Is it true that our conservationists, our environmentalists, the David Attenboroughs, Jane Goodalls of this world should not travel, should just stay home and forget spreading their message? Because you can absolutely guarantee that the Donald Trumps, the Scott Pruitts, the, you know, the heads of all of the big carbon companies, they ain't going to stop traveling. So for me at present, I think it's about thinking about every single action, trying to find what you can do to offset any impact you're having. And forest purchase is a really powerful one for me because it has the extra added effect that you're preserving biodiversity. By buying a big chunk of forest in Borneo, you're not just offsetting your carbon, you're providing a home for orangutans and proboscis monkeys and pygmy elephants. So that at present is where I'm driving my energy, with the knowledge that in 10 years' time, I'm probably going to have a rethink.
There a huge fire going on there at the moment?
There are always huge fires going on there. It's, horrific.
My daughter said something to me, really. I want to get onto the questions in a minute, but I'll just quickly put this to you. My daughter came home last night and said, "Dad, do you know what the most successful animal in the world is?" And I went, "No." And she said, she was laughing when she said this. She said, "The chicken. There's 25 billion chickens in the world, and it's the most successful animal. Sadly, they only live for 3 months before they're killed."
Yeah, it depends how you measure success.
Exactly. She started laughing. She says, "Depends how you measure success." But by making themselves tasty in the world's favourite food, they have actually become
chickens.
Their DNA. So, are they the most successful animal or not? Who knows? I mean, when laboratory protein comes along, the chicken will be in decline. So, I mean, I don't, it's still, we ended up discussing it for like 20 minutes going, is that success or is that just not successful? But at least they're still going, I suppose. Right, what one piece of advice would you like to give our listeners that has been invaluable to your life?
Don't fear failure. I have learned far, far more from all my mistakes than I've ever learned from my successes. Throw yourself into situations. If you get it wrong, you'll probably end up a better person for it.
All right, brilliant. Next question then. What's the biggest mistake you've made?
I would say my rock climbing fall in 2010, which was totally my own fault. And I broke my back in two places, smashed up my left ankle, and have never been the same since. So yeah, that was definitely my biggest mistake.
Okay. Any life hacks?
Life hacks. Always shake out your boots in the morning.
We don't have to do that in Britain.
The amount of times I've got out of my hammock and I've shook out my boots and I've had scorpions, venomous centipedes, venomous snakes. One time I didn't shake out my boots. I put my feet inside them and they were full of cockroaches which literally swarmed up my legs. So yeah, always shake out your boots.
Are you good at packing?
Hacking? What?
Packing.
Packing?
Yeah.
Yeah. Pack as little as you possibly can get away with.
Right.
In every situation.
What's the one essential you think you need?
Well, I always used to say super glue because we kind of use it for blisters and wound sealing and all that kind of stuff. But I can hear all the teachers and doctors and people go, "Don't say that, for goodness sake."
Bizarrely, that's what one of my daughters said the other day. "Why don't we just super glue our cuts up?" And I went, "Because you're not allowed to." But apparently you are. Yeah. Right. Okay. Can you recommend a book?
Oh, yes. I have 1,000, but I would say Climbing Mount Improbable by Richard Dawkins completely changed my perception of how the natural world works. It all of a sudden took me from someone who just learned facts and stats about animals to someone who looked at animals and tried to figure out what they meant.
Brilliant. And finally, what's the meaning of life?
fatherhood.
Okay.
My perspective on life has completely transformed from becoming a father. I was a very, very selfish and driven individual until I became a dad. And now, all of a sudden, I've just got a sense that there is more to it than that.
It gives you a meaning of life, definitely. As soon as my twins were born, I suddenly had this feeling of, oh, I know what I'm here for now.
Yeah.
I've got to make sure that they survive. And that's my job now, is to make sure I can get them up into adults. I'm not sure I've done a very good job.
I'm sure you have. There is a level of contentment from having Logan falling asleep on my chest at night, snoring away.
Oh, lovely,
that
isn't it?
I cannot describe.
Oh, it's amazing, yeah. It's amazing. If anyone wants to follow you, what's the best way of doing it?
I am on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook as, I think, Steve.Batchel or Steve Batchel Official. And yeah, I'm trying to stay as active as possible for someone who's mostly in the jungle.
And your book, Expedition, you wrote as you went round, didn't
you? I did.
So you can get that now. And what's your next project?
Next project, I'm just finishing another series of Deadly 60, which is mostly conservation driven. And then maybe some more expeditions. Who knows?
If Helen will let you.
Yeah.
All right. Cheers, Steve. Thank you so much. Brilliant.
Thank you very much, mate.
Steve Batchel there. Thoroughly enjoyed the conversation with him. He's not going to be lying on his deathbed going, my life was boring, is it?
I really should have packed some more into that. He'll probably be lying on a bed of fire ants or something.
the first time someone, you know, there was like a firearm involved in my life, I'd be thinking, any other jobs going in TV? Can I do a quiz? Something like that. I wouldn't be going, hey, I'll go back out and give it another go. And yeah, I want to be stung by ants. Amazing though, what experiences. I mean, just every time I meet him, we just talk and talk and talk and don't, because there's so much to ask him. I reckon I could have done a good 3 hours, 4 hours on just talking to him about expeditions, etc. Anyway, this podcast is sponsored by Cooker, and Steve and Helen have got themselves a cooker.
Yeah.
Because they came in and they went, you've got a cooker. They love their cooker. Boiling hot, 100 degree water. He said, you end up drinking a lot of brews though, don't you? And I say, yeah, I do. I drink some herbal tea and I drink normal tea. I drink the lot. But my cooker, as you know by now, regular listeners, it does 100 degree boiling hot water. It does your normal hot, your normal cold. You can wash up with, because it's a combi tap. It also does filtered water, very chilled filtered water. And mine has sparkling filtered water as well. And Mark keeps on stealing my bubbles.
They're delicious.
Every time he comes round, he fills it and I look at him.
Nice.
I go, you're stealing my bubbles,
Mark.
Spherical
bubble.
Keeps filling up bottles with his bubbles.
And also, you also have 100 degree boiling hot water as well, don't you?
I did say that.
Did you? I wasn't listening to you, Tim. I shut off when you're talking.
You were thinking about the bubbles.
I'm so glad you don't interview me, because I go, what? Sorry, what was that? What were you asking me?
I'm going to ask you one of my questions. What's the biggest mistake you've made?
Starting this podcast with you, Tim.
Okay. Damn you. Can you recommend a book?
Steve Batchel's Expedition.
Good. Any life hacks?
Oh, man, that's hard. No.
What one piece of advice you'd like to give our listeners that's been invaluable to your life?
Yeah, again, I wasn't listening. Sorry,
just steal Andy Nyman's.
Oh, yeah, that was good, wasn't it?
You love that one, don't you?
Yeah.
I love that one. We're not going to tell you.
If you want to know,
go back and listen to it. What's the meaning of life, Mark? Beer.
No. Well, yes.
Which leads us nicely into
Why
Beer 52.
Why did I say 52? No? I ruined that segue. I do apologise, Tim. Once again, I wasn't listening.
Tell us about Beer 52, Mark.
Beer 52, Tim, are a craft subscription, craft ales and beer subscription service. They take all beers from all around the world, from all different independent breweries, package them up, and they send them to you. And our listeners can claim a free case of beer. Beer52.com, that's beer52.com/Lovejoy. Claim a free case of 8 beers, a snack, and the magazine Ferment, for just the postage, which is £5.95. That will start off a subscription. You can cancel that subscription at any time you like. We've had some great fun on this podcast trying the beers, And I recommend their beers quite highly.
Yeah, so they just feature a different part of the world, as Mark said.
Or a
so,
theme, yeah.
Yeah, so it's a theme or different parts. So we've had Korea was one of the ones. It's the one I always remember. I don't know why I always remember Korea.
Because it was someone from North Korea, and we thought that's an unusual job to
unusual,
go to
yeah.
independent breweries in North Korea and go, well, can I try some of your beer,
yeah,
please?
Yeah, Fraser, who runs the company, went to North Korea.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah. So beer52.com/lovejoy if you want to subscribe to that. Right, so part two of this podcast, even though it's not part two with Steve Backshaw, it's with his wife, Helen Glover, who's she's so lovely, and I think you'll thoroughly enjoy the podcast with her. That'll be out on Monday. Please, can you let us know what you think of these podcasts? You can rate us on where do you rate
iTunes.
Us? iTunes. You can leave a comment there, but you can subscribe to us, which would be lovely.
Five stars,
if you did
please.
That. Yeah.
Pleasant.
If there's anything you want to talk to us about, you can email us at dearlovejoypodcast@gmail.com. And you can always contact me at Twitter. I love your feedback. @TimLovejoy is my Twitter address. Give us your feedback, good or bad. I don't care. Well, I do, actually.
Yeah, you do. It really hurts when it's bad.
Oh, don't give me bad stuff. Honestly, I can't sleep at night. That's it. So we'll see you next Monday with Helen Glover. Peace and love, Joy.
Bye.